You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Welcome to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Now, your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M Squared TechCast right here at PodcastDetroit.com.
The only podcast you're listening to right now. I was waiting for the rest of
Okay, well, maybe. Yeah. But you could have one in one ear and one in the other,
Good
I suppose.
Point, yes. Yeah,
multitasking.
Yes. So calling in from way down in downtown Detroit. We're based out of Royal Oak.
That's all 11 miles away.
All 11 miles away. We have Lisa Reynolds, who handles marketing and a whole bunch of other stuff for the Michigan Science Center. Also, we have with us Leslie Tom, who's the Chief Sustainability Officer for the Charles Wright Museum, which is right next door there. And so they've got a new project they're going to be telling everybody about, innovation. So fill it in there. Who wants to take the ball?
Hi, Mike. This is Lisa. And Leslie and I are thrilled to be here to talk about one of our latest initiatives, which we call Ripple of Impact, which is really about how our two museums, the Michigan Science Center and Charles H. Wright Museum of African American Culture and History, are working together on a sustainability project.
Okay, go ahead.
We've been working together for the past 3 years. It's been pretty exciting because, as you know, John Anderson, who's the interim CEO of the Michigan Science Center, came from the Detroit Zoo and worked on about $50 million of projects, one of them being the biodigester at the Detroit Zoo. And when I came in through the Detroit Revitalization Fellowship through Wayne State, at the Charles H. Wright Museum, we sort of bumped into each other and said, why are we doing sustainability alone? Why are we not trying to do things together? And so with the help of USGBC Advanced Program, which is the building certification group of LEED here in Detroit, we had about 90 different experts, architects, engineers, building contractors come and help us realize that we could start to do sustainability together. So two heads are better than one.
Okay.
And this project is really about making sure that we're walking the talk in terms of being good water stewards so that we can teach these lessons to our own visitors at our museum. You know, we're in this for the long haul, and we know that we need to think sustainably, and we want our community, our neighbors, and all of our visitors to be able to do that too. And one of the things that we know is that museums are trusted by people, much more so than by government very often. They know that the information that they're getting is objective information. And so we are really, I'm just leveraging this opportunity to share information and demonstrations with our audience, with people of Detroit. We're inviting the community in to share with us kind of what they envision as they think about sustainability, incorporating their views into this project as well.
So
Joel Harani Harris was sort of the first sustainability director from the mayor's office at the city of Detroit. And he declared that he wants Detroit to become the greenest city in America. So how can the museum start to help to become catalysts and examples to make the museums more green?
So can you give me some examples of maybe concrete steps you're taking in terms of sustainability there, things you weren't doing before?
Yeah, great. So we just got a grant from the Earth Family Foundation to help us plan out a little bit more of how we're going to consider green stormwater infrastructure. And it's so great because it gave us the opportunity to not just build green stormwater infrastructure, which includes things like rain gardens or bioswales, but to think about how can a museum context build this well. So we want to be able to think about how do we include community values? How do we include community vision? How do we start to
talk about green stormwater infrastructure and tell the story of water from a cultural African-American history and cultural perspective, as well as a science perspective. So we want to try to get into issues of water justice and of climate change with these two museums and provide experiences and places to inspire our next generation to be water stewards.
I think, Matt, doesn't LTU have a big program in that area as well?
Yeah, I might be. Yeah, hit the bell there.
Hit the bell.
Yeah, that's our shameless plug bell where we plug our employers.
Give that to Richard. He's the custodian of that.
Steward of the shameless plug bell.
Yeah,
I did want to tell both of you, I am going to send you an email after the program today. Lawrence Tech has something called the Great Lakes Stormwater Management Institute and a professor there, Don Carpenter, who's an expert in these things. He may be able to help you. At least
well, it's funny because Don Carpenter is actually our engineer on the
ah, well, world,
so I don't need the email. Okay, gotcha. You're already in touch.
Yeah, and if anyone wants to see Don Carpenter, we're going to be having a launch of this initiative November 14th at both of our museums at 10 a.m. We'll start in the Charles H. Wright Museum, and then we'll have a walking tour to the Detroit Independent Freedom Schools youth garden that helps to conserve some water here, and to the bioswale project at the Michigan Science Center.
So are your buildings then going to have those rooftop green garden kinds of things? Are you going to go in that direction?
Well, it's funny because I think we are part of this cultural connections project that the DIA Plaza project is pulling together. In fact, there's an open public meeting this Wednesday from 6 to 8 at the Charles H. Wright Museum. And anyone can kind of provide input and suggestions. And I think part of the idea is, yes, make these suggestions. I mean, why not have rooftop gardens that are connected to every single building with bridges and solar power? And I think it's really exciting that the Detroit Cultural Center could sort of become an example for how museums are doing sustainability well and be a demonstration, public demonstration space for all different types of people to experience these green gardens, these rooftop gardens, solar power, all these different sorts of technologies to help save the world.
Hmm. You'll have to get the Institute of Arts across the street involved, too. That's a lot of rooftop there.
Oh, yes. There's about 12 different stakeholders that the DIA Plaza Project is convening. And it's such an opportunity because I've heard that there's only one other place in the United States that has, universities, cultural districts, libraries, museums, schools in one space, and that's in D.C., Washington, D.C. So to have for there to be such a history and forethought of providing so many cultural assets in one space is very exciting to see how all of us can work together to become more green, to become better catalysts for our community well-being.
All right. Other than the sustainability project, we did want to let both of you talk a little bit about your major fall events here. I don't know who wants to go first, but either the Science Center or the African-American Museum. Just go ahead, whoever wants to start, and give us a couple of highlights from your fall calendar.
Okay. Well, one of the big ones for the Michigan Science Center is coming up on October 20th. It's an event we call Ignite, and it's a night at the museum. It's from 6 to 10 p.m. on October 20th. And it is for all ages. It's a chance to really come experience all that the Michigan Science Center has to offer. We're going to have live stage shows. We'll have hands-on exhibits, of course, and also some DIY activities that you can take home. So we'll have some dessert as well, so nothing like sweet treats to help. And for those who would like to purchase alcohol, we'll have that available too. But it's just a nice night out on the town at the Michigan Science Center. So definitely come out, you and your family. And then, of course, every third Thursday, we have our After Dark event from 6 to 9 p.m., and that's for ages 21 and up only. So if you want to come out and make it a happy hour night The Michigan Science Center offers that, with our theme in October being Doomsday Prepper. Of course, we're looking towards Halloween, so we wanted to have a theme appropriate with that.
Doomsday, is that what you said?
Survive an apocalypse.
Okay, yeah, that's important. The zombie apocalypse. Yeah, and all these shows on TV, I know it's going to come, right? You know, so.
So you want to be prepared.
Yeah, for sure. And lastly, what do you got?
At the Wright Museum, we just launched our opening of the Aretha Franklin exhibit.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. We had the viewing of Aretha Franklin, and about 30,000 people came through.
Good grief.
Which was great to sort of see such a Detroit icon get such respect. We also have a OU Fancy exhibit that's going on currently, where you can see African-American fashion and hair. And there's so many different public programs tied to both of these exhibits. Quincy Troop is involved with a lot of different events at our museum. So you'll just check out our website, www.thewright.org, for more information.
Okay. I was saying we've got Joe Louis Fisk downtown. We should have something from Aretha downtown, too. I just don't know what that would be.
A hand holding a microphone,
yeah,
maybe,
that would
or something.
Be good. Yeah, I like that. Yeah. So we should lobby the powers that be to create such a thing, right?
Yeah, that's great.
Lisa, I noted on your website, we do a tiny little bit of show prep here.
That you're not always, but sometimes.
Sometimes. That you've got one of your STEMinista events coming up, too, on Saturday the 13th. Talk about that a little bit, if you could.
We do. So the STEMinista Project is really our initiative focused on getting girls in grades 4 through 8 interested in STEM through STEM experiences and also exposure to role models, so they can see women who kind of look like them and understand the careers that they're in. And this Saturday, our event is around coding. So definitely, you know, bring your daughter, your niece, your neighbor, a girl who would just like to learn a little bit more about science, technology, engineering, and math out to that event. It's a very popular one.
What's the age range for that?
So we do it based on grades. So if you're in grades 4 through 8.
Wow, young then. Okay.
You can sign up on our website, which is www.mi-sdi.org.
You'd be surprised, though. I've seen kids in those grades come up with some pretty interesting, you know, computer games and other things based on the code they learn how to write, even at that early age.
They learn very quickly.
Scary
and
almost.
One more sustainability activity that the Michigan Science Center and the Charles H. Wright Museum are doing is we're part of the second annual Sustainable Detroit Forum produced by USGBC Detroit. It'll be October 24th from 9 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. at Wayne State University. We were part of this last year at their sort of initial sustainability launch, and it was great. There's just people really interested from all over the community, Detroit and Southwest Michigan, talking about sustainability projects, connecting with each other. We will be talking a little bit more about our sustainability projects that we've been doing together with data-driven sort of projects and experience-driven projects and demonstrations. And it's just a really good time to meet other people that are trying to make the city more green.
Okay. Got less than 2 minutes left. Why don't you give us one more round of folks are interested in getting more information about your respective museums, how they can do that.
Okay. Well, certainly we invite you to check us out on Facebook and Twitter, but also if you go to our website for the Michigan Science Center at www.mi-sdi.org, you can see our whole calendar of events for the next several months. And I'm sure that there's something in there for you. So check us out on our homepage and for the Charles H. Wright Museum. Yeah, our website again is thewright, thewright.org. Every second Sunday, we have a free DTE-sponsored Sunday. So bring your family down to check out our exhibits. And we would love to also be able to invite you to October 20th. There's another sustainability ribbon cutting that we're having down at Jefferson Chalmers. Ash Arter and Aaron Jones helped to build a solar-powered projection set
and it'll be launching to the Jefferson Chalmers community that day.
All right.
So, yeah, thank you. Thank you for all this time.
All right, no problem. Thanks very much, Lisa Reynolds from the Michigan Science Center, Leslie Tom from the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History and Culture. Thanks to both of you for appearing today. We'll be right back in just a minute with another segment of the M Squared TechCast. Until then, this is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're indeed listening to the M Squared TechCast.
Lawrence Technological University graduates earn a degree and a higher starting salary. In fact, when it comes to earning potential, the Brookings Institution ranks LTU fifth among U.S. colleges and universities. Be enriched. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
As a Lawrence Technological University graduate, you're not only marketable, you're worth more. Yes, more. According to payscale.com, when it comes to graduate salaries, LTU is in America's top 100. Be invaluable. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Hey, it's Mike Brennan.
And it's Matt Rausch.
I caught you there. You were going to start, weren't you?
I was.
And you're listening to the second segment of M Squared TechCast, and we have, well, we have the same person, but with a new title. We have with us Tim Boucher, previously from Inforum's Engage program. Well, she's been recruited away for big bucks from now Invest
Still
Detroit.
Start up.
Invest Detroit, where she's now the portfolio manager.
Yes.
And she has one of her portfolio companies with her. See, I was segueing into that. See, there's some
fabulous
logic
job
to this, right? Mm-hmm. And so we have with us Peter, is it Felzen?
It's Felzen. Yes.
Felzen, CEO of Ripple Science. Not when I think of Ripple, I think of something else. So hopefully it's not that, right?
from your youth, I hope. So.
Don't drink that anymore.
Yeah.
So, but yours is something, what Timber sent me was, it improves the recruitment and management of research participants.
That's interesting.
That's
how
correct.
So?
So Ripple Science is a University of Michigan spin-out, and the company provides a cloud-based software solution for people who do clinical research.
Huh.
And if you look at clinical research, the pharma industry spends about $71 billion a year on clinical research.
Big bucks.
And if you start digging into where the bottlenecks and problems and inefficiencies are, there are two metrics that Ripple is going after to try and move the needle. The first is recruiting patients. Uh-huh. So 70% of studies don't meet their patient recruitment targets. And about 60% of the studies that are ceased or don't continue are stopped because of insufficient patient recruitment.
Huh.
So that's a big problem that if we can solve it or if we can make it better, there's a lot of savings there for the industry. The second is patient retention. 30% of patients enrolled in clinical trials drop out before the trial finishes.
Huh.
So we want to fix that also, and that's what we're working on.
These folks are paid, though, to do all this stuff, right? These research, not the researchers themselves, but a lot of the patients or people that are in the trials are paid. So they drop out because variety of reasons, huh?
It's interesting. When you get into medical research where most of the money is spent, that's not the case.
Really?
The conventional wisdom is that, oh, yeah, I get paid to participate in this clinical trial. And there are a lot of academic trials and a lot of marketing trials that takes place. But in medical research, physicians are usually engaged to find patients that meet inclusion criteria with certain conditions.
Sure.
And they're either offered the treatment or they've agreed for the sake of science to be enrolled in a study. So the majority of real scientific research, the things that gets drugs and medical devices out the door, is not paid research. Mm. And so we really – the coordinators who are recruiting these patients, they need a good tool and a workflow and a process to do that efficiently and effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And none of them are actually trained. They're mostly researchers. So they're trained in research. They're not trained in marketing to find patients for a trial.
Mm-hmm.
So we try and give them the templates and the examples and the workflows
mm-hmm.
and make that as simple for them as possible, as approachable for them as possible, so they can be better at it and spend more time on research.
Huh.
Yeah. So a couple of things. I'm going to go back just a hot minute talk a little bit about feeder. Jumped way ahead of me today.
Oh, sorry.
They went right into the meat, didn't they?
They did. They
you
went
said
right
ripple,
forward.
And they got my mind rolling. I know.
So Peter actually is the president and CEO of Ripple Science. They're based in Ann Arbor. He actually is a native of Michigan. He's an alum of the University of Michigan Ross School of Business. Also, he currently serves as the executive in residence at the Mike Ilitch School of Business at Wayne State, the brand new business school.
That earlier reference to Wayne State, now it all
fits
in. Exactly.
Yes, okay.
Exactly. And he has spent 20 years managing life science companies and teams in San Francisco and Silicon Valley. Okay. So he has a little bit different take on the things that are happening here. So with Ripple Science, so the two academic founders at the University of Michigan, what do you think they did right when they launched the company out of the university?
They worked hard and didn't take salaries. That's the most important thing for investors like Invest Detroit, right? That there's dedication and capital efficiency. The last thing that early stage investors want is founders to squander the funds. So I think the most important thing, though, is Nestor Lopez Duran is a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan, and he does early childhood development research in the area of depression. And so Nestor had several government grants, NIH grants, to study this condition in children. And he had sites, pediatricians and doctor's offices recruiting patients for his studies and managing, bringing them back in for follow-up. And he's the one who noticed the problem. So Ripple Science came out of a real doctor doing research that recognized this was the bottleneck in the process and went to work for several years to fix it. And the outcome of that was the software and the suite of tools that we now provide to universities all over the world, not just the U.S.
So how were they able to recruit you? What was the attraction for the opportunity at Ripple?
So my background is in medical devices and life sciences. So I've worked with bringing many new technologies to market and a little bit in genetics. And 3 years ago, I started spending more time back in Detroit. My family is here. I bought a loft in Eastern Market, and I was just going to land there while I was in Detroit for family reasons. But the more time I spent in Detroit, the more I realized that, wow, what's going on here really feels like south of Market in San Francisco and Silicon Valley 20 years ago when I landed there. So much potential, so much energy, and so much hope that it's really happening this time. President Roy Wilson at Wayne State is an ophthalmologist, so I hadn't worked with him in the past, but many people in my industry had. So I had a first conversation with him and got a little involved in Wayne State. And then I got involved with the University of Michigan Tech Transfer Office. And when I saw Ripple, I just thought, okay, you know, just when you look at the portfolio companies in the venture center at these universities that are moving technology out of the lab into the world, there are some signs that it's ready or it's not. And the first sign is usually, is somebody else who's not a friend using their product and paying for it? And if you look at the world of software, in the SaaS world, we usually look for 10 unaffiliated customers, which means not, you know, the net lab next door or not someone at my university who's actually paying to use this stuff. And by the time I looked at Ripple, they had 44, I think, the first time I looked at them this spring. Unaffiliated customers. So that meant to me that they had a validated product that there was some use for out there. Then I went and looked at what their customers say. And there's a website called Capterra where software is reviewed, kind of like the Yelp for software.
Right.
19 reviews, all 5 stars. And the comments from their customers is, this makes my life so much easier. I'm able, you know, it's improving my study. So
So you talked about the product solving a bottleneck. What bottleneck?
Yeah, give us the mechanics of how it actually works.
Yeah, so, and how it solves the problem.
Right.
I'm just curious.
So the main bottleneck is when when a study protocol is approved, the clinical sites are selected, and those sites have usually trial coordinators or study coordinators specifically at the site. And their job is to look at the inclusion criteria. So if, you know, the world I came from, I did a lot of glaucoma work. So the glaucoma trials would be, I need African-American females over 75 years old that have macular degeneration and glaucoma. Boom. So they have to go and find these people either in their own patient population or in their community. So, and none of them are trained to do it. So our product has been described as a CRM, a customer resource management tool, specifically designed for people who do clinical trials that can keep demographic information, not the trial data, but demographic information about the patients in one system, safe and secure, HIPAA compliant. And we also provide them with examples of, for that type of patient group, we've done this type of email campaign, and this is the effectiveness in five other trials. That type of communication wasn't so effective, and here's some data that shows you from similar trials. So we just try and we try to be the experts so that they can get that job done efficiently and then focus on the research.
So you build a database essentially and you let folks harvest it with keywords or something in order to determine what they're looking for in a patient.
It's basically a tool and they're putting most of the data in, but that's a really important point because one of the assets that we're building also is a data registry.
Yeah.
So there are currently 60,000 patients whose information is in the Ripple system because of the patients that have been loaded in the studies from our customers around the world.
Huh.
And someday that'll be 500,000 and someday that'll be 5 million. And then those patients who opt in to be contacted for research in the future are searchable, and so our customers will be able to populate their studies, find patients through our own registry as well.
Huh. So if you're looking for someone with X conditions but not A, B, and C conditions, that kind of thing, they will be in there and that'll all be, you know, vetted. You'll be able to search
that
way.
Yes, and you can, and if the A, B, and C data isn't in there, at least you can find the patients that meet X criteria, send them a questionnaire, mm-hmm. and ask them if they meet A, B, or C, and then find the real candidates for your study.
Mm-hmm. All served up from the cloud, right?
Yes, it's all in the cloud.
That is the future, yes.
Indeed.
I think it's the present.
It's the present, yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
It is the present.
I'm sorry, we keep stepping on your interview.
That's all right. Okay. This is a team effort, guys.
And now there's 2 minutes left. Okay.
Yeah, there's two minutes left. So that's great.
We ate up all of Tamper's time. Thank you very much.
Okay, yes.
So what a great company, what a great product, right? So are you looking to hire at the moment? Oh. And if you are, what
Matt's
skills are you looking for?
That's very good.
That's Matt's question, by the way.
Yes, so. Yes. So, so we are in the middle of hiring. I joined the company about 8 weeks ago. And the first job was the company is currently raising seed round of capital, about $750,000.
It's a big seed.
It's for Michigan, perhaps, yeah. It's, again, the company is very capital efficient. So our goal is with that to fill out the basic structure of the company. And so we've hired a director of customer success who has 10 years of industry experience. We promoted the woman who has been introducing and training all of our customers to Ripple since it started, since mm-hmm. the first product got out in the market. We've hired 2 development staff. We've hired a part-time chief technology officer who has done 6 software startups and knows the drill. So
sounds like he needs a CISO, though. What do you think, Richard? Richard is a CISO. So
a CISO? What's a CISO?
Turn his mic on here.
Chief Information Security Officer.
Oh, I see. Yes. And we spend a lot of time on security because we are HIPAA compliant. We
right.
have,
oh, yeah.
working with universities, the security, our security document is pretty deep.
Yeah, HIPAA, you screw that up, you're in rural trouble. Yeah. So.
And you know, people talk about companies in Michigan, there's a talent gap. I'm not finding that. What I see with especially the technology corridor universities and then the other universities in the area, there's a deep bench of talent. We need opportunities to keep them in Michigan.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think we got about a minute or so, right? All right. So if folks want more information about both of your companies, since you're
I'll let Peter go first.
Yes. Very
great.
Good.
So Invest Detroit is one of the funders of Ripple Science, mm-hmm. One of the very first funders, along with Invest Michigan and the Monroe Brown Fund at mm-hmm. the University of Michigan. And we are based in Ann Arbor, and you can find us at www.ripplescience.com.
And, perfect.
And now
Temper,
people,
your new employer.
Yes, your new email address, so I won't send it to your old email address.
Well, just a couple of quick things. Do I have a couple of seconds to talk?
Yeah, sure.
So Accelerate Michigan Innovation Competition is one of our programs for Invest Michigan. We have 24 companies that were just announced last week, and the finals are November 13th at the Lexus Velodrome. So join us. Register and join us for that.
I'll be there.
AccelerateMichigan.com.
I'll be back. And but also, shooting video, too. So
absolutely. Yeah. And we have one other program called Hacker Fellows. Where we work with emerging tech talent to get paid fellowships and internships in Michigan startups.
Mm-hmm.
So applications are open for that now for 2019, 15 fellows and 10 interns. So
okay.
Love to see that. And then
how do they do that? Give us a website.
InvestDetroitVentures.com.
There you go. Temper Shea, new portfolio manager. Moving on up, you know, so.
All right. And Peter Felsen, CEO of Ripple Science, thanks for being with us today. We'll be right back with another segment of the M Squared TechCast for right now.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M Squared TechCast at PodcastDetroit.com.
What do you get at Lawrence Technological University? Everything. Great labs and studios, supportive professors, plus a full campus life, NAIA athletics, and all the software you need to succeed. Be smart. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Lawrence Technological University is all about opportunities. You learn beyond the campus, doing real-world research for top companies and honing your skills through co-ops and internships. Apply what you learn. Be challenged. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And welcome back to another segment of the M Squared TechCast right here at the growing world encircling PodcastDetroit.com network.
With 100 shows now on the air,
and
all
counting.
Being engineered by Jessica. She
yes.
doesn't sleep at all, right, Jessica?
Right. We have the we still don't have a Jessica cam.
Oh, we're going to get that done.
Now she's
we're
afraid she's working
it in
too
here
hard.
When she's not ready for it. That'll be the best.
Okay.
So speaking of sneaking in here, but actually... an old friend of mine and co-author of a book that we wrote in 2011, and it's now been vindicated. I feel very good about it. A little cocky, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, we have with us Richard Steenen from IT Harvest, founder of RustNet. I know we have Ihor Diachenko down there,
right.
From 123net. So you can talk afterwards about all the wonderful things that managed service providers. So, but anyway, Richard's going to talk about some of the really crazy stuff going out there in cyber world.
Yes, we invite Richard in every couple of months to
scare
the crap
hell out
of us.
Yes, right. Where do we start? I guess our friends in Russia, the GRU agents.
Let's start with the GRU.
Okay.
Because it is scary. And in the security space, you know, we always think of our adversaries as these people that are way over there, usually outside of our jurisdiction.
Yep.
And they're attacking us and doing all sorts of crazy stuff. But the ultimate defense that you have to put in place is defending against when they actually deploy people to your facility and
yep.
try and break in, et cetera. So this week we learned from the Justice Department that they had indicted 7 GRU agents for doing this type of activity where they were deploying to different places around the world, including like Washington, D.C. and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in order to hack into the Wi-Fi systems of hotels and just the office
sort of
facilities.
Like real spear phishing there,
yeah.
huh?
Yeah, they couldn't get in with the regular spear phishing.
Mm-hmm.
So kudos to Westinghouse, who were their target in Pittsburgh, and kudos to the people who worked for the agencies that look at anti-doping in the Olympics. So those guys had to be attacked in Rio by agents that were deployed there. So this is a case of, you know, when there's a gray van parked outside your house, you really should be paranoid, as I often am.
Well, you know, the thing is, too, when you go back to the Mueller investigation, when he did his indictment of the GRU agents, I read that, and I was, like, amazed that the level of detail, they could say what they were having for breakfast that morning, what computer they were using. It's just the NSA has got to be a little spooky, too, right?
Yeah, the indictments we're seeing are a treasure trove for people like me who research this and try and record the history of it, because they are giving us the techniques and procedures, the methods that they use of this type of hacking. And the original indictment was of 12 GRU agents that were associated with hacking the Democratic National Committee during the election.
Sure.
So now we got this layered on top, and it came right after. So the first we heard of this most recent indictment came out of the Netherlands, where the Dutch said, hey, we just expelled 4 GRU agents and we captured a trunk load of the equipment they use for hacking Wi-Fi networks.
Is that a technical term, a trunk load?
Trunk load.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. All right.
And they,
in other words, the trunks are very small. So
yes.
True. And this is a rental car.
Yeah.
So they kicked them out of the country without their equipment, and they kept the equipment and told us that we'd hear more from the Justice Department the next day. So sure enough, we did.
Ooh.
And the reason that they're in The Hague is, one, they're hacking the committee for the anti-doping, but they're also hacking the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons, which, of course, post everything that's going on in Syria, that became a thing as people started accusing Russia of supplying those chemical weapons or somehow being involved. So all of a sudden, of course, Russia starts hacking into those organizations.
Mm-hmm. It's a fun world after all out there, I'll tell you. So.
And one thing I was curious about, the level of detail in these indictments seems kind of unusual for a criminal indictment. Is it because they know there's never going to be a trial because they're never going to get these hands on these guys? So they just
want
to let them know what we know?
Exactly.
Okay.
And the question has been raised, if the folks in the Netherlands knew the indictment was coming, why didn't they arrest them so they could extradite them to the U.S.? They let them out of the country.
I think that was politics. They didn't want the Ruskies on them.
Politics,
you know,
diplomacy.
Yeah.
Spy diplomacy, which is a different world unto itself.
Yeah, it is. And wasn't there something going on in the U.K. too, or not? Or was it just the Netherlands? Where I think GRU was over there too, right?
Yeah, and what's going on in the U.K. is that the GRU sent two agents, deployed them to Salisbury this past summer in order to basically bump off a former GRU spy. They botched that, and it ended up killing one other person who just accidentally found the perfume bottle that they had put this nasty, nasty poison, Novichok, in.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they've been back in the news is this amazing open source group called Bellingcat. And it's called that because they are belling the cat. They just pieced together publicly available information to positively identify one of the guys that the UK has said were one of the poisoners. They've identified what unit in the GRU and in the military that he served under. And now they've found the other guy too. And they're piecing it all together with open source information.
I wondered about that too, about why the Russians use such a specific poison that only they make.
They're sending
a message there too.
Sending very strong messages.
Yeah.
Novichok sounds like a 70s detective show.
Yeah.
So. On the next Novichok.
As the way they are bumping off journalists in EU countries right now, right? They're making it pretty obvious that it's not a simple, clean
death.
There
was a Bulgarian woman who was murdered that was discovered today, I think.
That's
investigative journalist. Yes.
Yep.
It's not just the Russians. It's also our great and good friends, the Chinese.
Yeah.
There's a Bloomberg report on the Chinese embedding spy chips. Why don't you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah. So when this Bloomberg report was published, you know, all hell broke loose in the world of industrial control system security, because everybody, including Mike and I in a book, have predicted that this was going to happen.
7 years ago. But did they listen to us?
Yeah.
No.
And actually, the inspiration for that, and this was pre, you know, NSA tapping into Cisco gear before it shipped, right? So we predicted that too. But the inspiration for that was a story I heard from a local guy. I met him in a, you know, Arby's or something. And he told me the story.
It'd be better if you met him in a bar. Sorry.
Yeah,
I'm just going to say
it was lunchtime.
Okay.
Well, you know.
Okay.
And he told the story of discovering an extra chip on the motherboards put in the Abrams tanks built here at Tank Automotive Command. And they've tried to figure out, hey, you know, how come this chip isn't in the design? You know, where's your engineering change order? And the story he tells is that they discovered that that chip could be, it was a Wi-Fi chip, and it was connected to the fuel pumps for the tanks. In other words, in a battle, the Chinese would be able to throttle down the tanks.
Turn off the fuel pump.
Yeah, turn off the fuel pump so the tanks would stop.
That's a bad thing in a battle. That would be a really bad thing.
That became known as the Manchurian chip. Yeah. And you can Google it, and there's not very, you know, the story is different from the things you find on Wikipedia. But it was obviously, what a great way to hack your adversary.
And it was the plot of Cyber Stiletto, the novella that we wrote. So
that's right.
Our airport read is about, 50,000 words. We wanted to have something where you get on the plane in New York. By the time you got to L.A., you could finish the book.
Yeah, and if you read it, you'll be the second person to read it.
No, I got a copy.
Self-publishing.
Make it the third.
Yeah. Self-publishing. Yes. Yeah. So you get so much out of that, right? So we made $0.
And speaking of books, yes. So I just wrote a review on Forbes. There's that.
Oh, yeah. Get that bell. Yeah.
Okay.
For a new book called Like War by Peter Singer and this guy Emerson Brooking, both policy wonks and cyber historians. And they've come up with a new book on social media and warfare, probably to date the best book on the topic that's come out. It's very, very current and up to date, though, you know, obviously things happen every single week. So they didn't include anything we just talked about in the book. But it's all about how social media has been engaged in these influence campaigns that led us to the world we're in today.
Oh, my gosh.
Check it out.
Yeah, what a mess. Honestly, it's just going to get scarier as it goes along because everyone's getting better at it, right?
Yeah. It's starting to get a little too scary for me. I might just get out of this business.
So what?
He has vans parked out in front of his place all the time. What's up with that?
Okay. You know, so. All right.
And the cellular, our phones will stop working when the vans are out there. Tell me what that means.
Ooh.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
So what about the midterm elections? What are they doing there, these various bad actors?
So the interesting – so sure enough, they're cranking up their activity. So look for divisiveness, right? So, you know
– Look. I think we've seen it, yeah.
So the Russians don't have, you know, a particular interest in Republicans versus Democrats. They have an interest in –
stirring the pot.
Being America being dysfunctional.
Yeah,
right.
Make America dysfunctional. So just look for anything that's super divisive.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those things – is all of a sudden we see Trump parroting things that he reads or somebody reads in the Russian press about China. And all of a sudden you've got the president of the United States saying China's a much worse hacker of the upcoming elections, okay? So there's some disinformation being fed us. And all of a sudden through Bloomberg, we hear about the chips embedded in servers that
a company that Amazon's using.
And, you know, it's coming out of China. The poor company, Supermicro, that makes those boards, their stock dropped in half the day that happened. Think of that as actual disinformation because both or all of Apple – Amazon, the GCHQ, which is a spy agency in the UK, and DHS have come out and said there's nothing true in that story whatsoever.
Right.
In other words, somebody planted the story. So we're all ready to believe it. That's the best thing about disinformation. When something comes out that we believe we want it to have happen deep down, then we're ready to spread it and get it out there. So,
So
now you got to look at everything with that litmus test.
Got about 2 minutes left. What can we hit real fast in 2 minutes?
Well, I guess the one thing that we haven't seen yet is actually military engagement.
Mm-hmm.
So keep an eye on the South China Sea.
The big exercise is coming up.
Yep, and where China has recently tried to scare off some of the U.S. Navy frigates.
Like
and
within 20 yards of a ship.
Yeah, you know, right. 15 yards of a ship, force them to change direction, which is kind of the small test for an engagement, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you actually have to move one of those ships, then that was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
That happened. And there was nothing cyber associated with that just yet, but look forward to the moment when there is a physical engagement between the two, and then we'll see what
Because you predicted
China
it,
has.
And there will be cyber war.
That's exactly. And it's still 2018, which is the year I predicted it for. So we've got a couple months to go.
Well, hopefully you'll be wrong on that. So we won't have World War III start in the South China Sea, right? You know, so. All right. So folks want to get in touch with you to be scared all the time, Richard. How do they do that?
Just follow me on Twitter. My handle is Cyberwar.
Okay. And you're up, still writing for Forbes too, right?
Yeah, I write for Forbes.
Okay, cool.
All right, that's cybersecurity expert Richard Steenen, a longtime friend of the show, on one of his periodic appearances to scare the crap out of all of us.
Yep, we only let him in every couple of months because we can't handle it.
Mission accomplished, sir. Well done. All right, we'll be right back with another segment of the M-Squared TechCast. For right now, this is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M-Squared TechCast at PodcastDetroit.com.
Lawrence Technological University is more than a school. It's a launchpad for your future, offering industry-leading facilities and 100-plus programs that are ranked among the nation's best. Be unstoppable. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Lawrence Technological University graduates earn a degree and a higher starting salary. In fact, when it comes to earning potential, the Brookings Institution ranks LTU fifth among U.S. colleges and universities. Be enriched. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at ltu.edu.
Oh. Caught us. We're back.
All right. And everyone
we
became
only have
silent.
1 minute between segments.
With about a half a second to spare, everyone yes. became silent. So that's good. Okay. It's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And we're back with another segment of the M-Squared TechCast. Right now, we're going to talk self-driving cars.
We are.
Okay.
And we have with us Ihor Diachenko. I'm getting that right every time.
Absolutely.
Yep. Marketing director.
That's correct.
Getting all these titles. This is not like me. I'm pronouncing names right and getting titles right. And we have John Ironman, a senior sales engineer. Did I get that right?
That is correct.
All right. God, batting 100 there. So anyway, you guys are going to be talking about driving autonomous vehicles. And we have a little crib sheet here on some of the stuff you want to talk about. There's a big race in mobility, as we all know. And do you want to throw that in now, or we can hold that for later?
We can hold it for later.
Okay. Yeah, and top OEMs are investing billions into autonomous technology. I know why, but you tell us why.
Yeah, so I think there's quite a few reasons out there, one of them being the biggest one being safety. For the National Highway Traffic Administration actually estimates that 94% of all accidents are caused by drivers. So that's one of them. But for the OEMs, one of their biggest reasons, obviously, is cost. They can actually, you know, reduce their cost by doing automation. And another one is traffic, right? So currently, with traffic, there is estimated about 2,200 cars per hour per lane. And when they go to automation, they think they can get that up to about 8,200 per lane. So that's
sounds like Detroit during rush hour. But
yeah. You know, it's funny. I rented a car with adaptive cruise control. I had never had it before for a trip over Labor Day weekend, and it was actually a much more calm experience. I had to drive through Chicago in late rush hour traffic as I left here Detroit at the crack of dawn, headed for Minneapolis, right? And it was actually much less stressful to just leave the car in adaptive cruise control mode at the setting where it would go as close to the vehicle in front of you as it would, because if I backed it off to leave more space between vehicles, then six people would cut in,
in front of me. Sure.
But it was a much less stressful experience to drive in a rush hour mode that way. You know, it was really interesting. It was an eye opener for me. I didn't think that was an important feature before. Now I'm sold on it. So.
Well, Matt and I have been talking about autonomous vehicles for a long time, but what's your take on autonomous vehicles?
Yeah, walk us through the various levels of autonomy to start with, just to give people background.
Yeah, so there's, levels 0 through 5. Level 0 is basically what you think of when you think of a regular driving car with no features, right?
That would be mine.
Go ahead. So most, but you know, adaptive.
You still crank the windows, do you?
Yeah. Okay.
All right, go ahead. I'm sorry.
AM radio, No,
that would be a pure level 0 right there if you're cranking the windows.
Yeah.
The level 1 is like the driver assistance. You know, those are some of the things that you're kind of used to, like the adaptive cruise control and those kind of things. Level 2 is partial automation. So you're looking at, you know, some of the features are automated. Some of them, so basically they're doing them for you. And level 3, conditional automation. high automation being 4 and full automation being 5. So that's kind of like where you get to like the Jetsons, right?
Mm-hmm. That's always I've had many conversations with many experts about that, and that'll be within the confines of a smart city where it's geofenced. There'll be small vehicles like you get in Europe, the little smart vehicles or something.
Yep.
You know, most of the people I've talked to don't think you're going to like do freeway drive from here to Grand Rapids in a level 5 car. They just won't have the infrastructure in place. But what do you think?
Yes, a lot of it will come down to a lot of the actual data they're ingesting, right? So if they're actually mapping that out, like they do today with, let's say, like the Google Earth vehicle, they have to drive those roads. It is possible that they could be doing this for full automation. I mean, I believe they're actually doing it in Europe today and in some places.
Well, and I've heard the Cadillac Super Cruise mode. I was at Awards Auto User Experience Conference last week, and they described that as being very much autonomous. A couple of guys from Awards Auto actually drove a Cadillac with their Super Cruise control in it, and they said they didn't touch the wheel, the brake, or the gas from Gaylord to suburban Detroit.
Oh, wow.
They came all the way down from.
So what would you call that? Is that a level 4?
That would be level 3, probably.
Yeah, that would be level 3.
Yeah,
level 3. Yeah, that would be classified where the driver
You still got to pay attention.
You got to pay attention, exactly. Yeah. So that's where the monitoring system comes into play, right? So that's kind of part of the levels, too, where at level 3, driver automation, the driver's still available to take control of the vehicle, right? Whereas in 4 and 5, it gets where the actual car will stop and make those modifications.
Well, we do have a level 5 running on downtown Detroit, May Mobility.
Yeah.
That little golf cart kind of thing that they call a bus. I think, 3 or 4 people could get jammed in there like sardines?
Well, there's a 6-person one at U of M, I think.
Yeah, that one's running around, too, on North Campus. But that's more of the engineering campus. You don't see it down on the main campus. Yeah.
Doesn't Lawrence Tech have one as well?
They're still working on the software for it. That's a little 2-passenger, essentially a smart car. C.J. Chung, our computer science prof, is working on he and his students are still working on the algorithms for that one. It's pretty good now. I've stepped in front of it before as it comes at me, and it does stop. So, you know, I mean, that's a good thing
to know. So, right. So
were you trying to get out of work?
So, workers' comp claim. Yeah, so here we go.
Change his underwear, but I mean, other than that. So
tell me why a connectivity company like 123net cares about these technologies. What's in it for you guys?
Yeah, so if you look at the mobility piece, a lot of that data is actually being ingested, whether it be LIDAR or radar or cameras, right? So all these different things are bringing in big data. Mm-hmm. And for a connectivity company like 123net, where we actually specialize as well in data centers, that's really where we come into play. That's how we tie in the mobility piece with these guys, because they're working on high-dense compute clusters to ingest all that data.
Yeah. Is the Detroit Internet Exchange, does that fit into this somewhere for that somehow?
Well, it does through actually fiber connectivity, right? The interconnects.
Yeah. So some of these carriers or some of these OEMs are going to be using the IX to exchange data locally, maybe with some of the cloud providers, maybe something like that. Yep.
All right. So I was going to say, what does 123.net provide that can crunch all this data?
So we're actually not crunching the data for people. What we're actually doing is we're providing the space because high-dense compute clusters actually require a substantial amount of power and a substantial amount of cooling. And that's where 123.net comes in, because we actually design our entire infrastructure for these things. So
high density co-location.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Yep. So what would be considered high density co-location maybe 3-4 years ago is not high density today, right? I mean, as we know, all the power and cooling and everything is substantially higher now.
Yeah.
So what we do is we actually will bring in and we'll take and find out exactly what the power usage is, and we'll design a private suite for these OEMs so that they're getting the maximum amount of cooling to the power usage that they're actually pulling.
Interesting.
So talk about the security that's required for this too, because one of the things that, you know, I've been leery about things like adaptive cruise control and automatic braking and lane departure warning is that if the car can take control of the vehicle systems,
who else could take control?
Yeah, someone could get into the car's systems. Yeah, through
power them Russians right?
Through the media center, through the main bus. I mean, you know. So talk about the security that's required for that.
I mean, I don't even know if there's going to be security after that last part, because that really scared me. quite honestly, a lot of these guys are just crunching the data there. They're really trying to bridge all these different systems together. So it's not like the controlling of the data. It's actually the ingestion. So they're just trying to figure out, like, was that a person or was that a telephone pole? That kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of stuff they're mostly doing within our data center today. They're not actually controlling the infrastructure. What you're referring to is like what they call vehicle to everything, yeah. Right? So that's where everything is communicating with everything and what's being controlled. And that's where the mobility of the vehicles will be actually be able to determine what a stoplight is or what a stop sign is. Whereas,
or when Matt's crossing the road, you know.
Exactly.
That would be good, you know. So
yeah, I don't want someone telling the car, hey, it's Matt, hit him.
Yeah,
right. Instead, they're trying to bump me off or something. Right?
Yeah. Luckily, I don't think you'd be able to get hit today because they probably, you know, as they're not very good at determining what those things are yet.
Yeah.
So it just, you know, figures item or stop, right?
Well, and I also noticed on the dashboard of the car, there were a couple of switches that looked like plain old on-off switches. I don't know if, you know, if they actually were would physically separate the system from the vehicle controls, but you could turn the lane departure warning off and you could turn the automatic braking off, you know, on the dashboard. So that would make me, if I was worried about that kind of thing, I might just turn them off. So, you know, I mean, if you can turn them off, then that's a good thing. And I did turn off the lane departure warning because it was irritating because I don't always use my turn signal.
You know? No,
I mean, I'm
really,
sorry, but you know, hey, well, come on, you know.
Did it keep pushing you back?
Always been a rebel, right. You know.
That's a Detroit driver for you. Yeah. You know, it's like you kind of guess where I'm going, man. Stay out of my way.
Yeah, that's it. Read my mind. So you guys do a lot of designing for high density environments. What are some of the elements of that?
Yeah, so when we look at high-dense areas, we're talking mostly about the power and cooling. So we actually, for ours, we actually look at the different types of cooling that are available. The biggest thing right now is not necessarily power. With 123net, we have our own dedicated substation from DTE, so we're able to
Drawing some real power then, huh?
Yeah, yeah. So we're able to basically push up to 20 megawatts worth of power into our facility. And in addition to that, we have some other backups for power, with which would be consumers' energy. Being, we actually create our own power there with our microturbines. We actually bring in natural gas for that, and we also have some other things that we do. But the bigger thing is actually the cooling, right? So these high dense compute clusters dump a substantial amount of heat, and a traditional air handler, for example, is not able to convert, rechilled air at that speed. So it's really comes down to the design. How do we push the appropriate amount of air as well as keep the humidity to the appropriate temperature and get all this stuff to move through the data center without impacting the customer, right? And the other thing too is, you know, if you're looking at that, what happens with the power, right? In terms of an outage, that's a lot of power draw.
Yeah.
So we have to be able to make sure that we have the backup systems. We have to also make sure we have backup cooling as well. So we can take one down for, let's say, you know, maintenance or whatever, we still have to provide a service to our customers. So
absolutely,
that's part of the design that goes into it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's I remember talking with people from Jan Ness and Company, who used to talk about Michigan being a great location for data centers because the amount of extra cooling was minimal because it's cold here a lot of the year. So
yeah, it's a sad stat. I think it's like 90% of the year it's less than 70 here.
Yeah, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I can believe that.
Except for today.
This week
it's
alone.
It's good for cooling.
This week we're going to be 80 degrees today and 50 degrees on Wednesday. You got to love Michigan.
Okay. Yes, another one that's actually a good point to that with Michigan is we don't have a lot of natural disasters either, right? So that's another great reason.
Tornado occasionally.
Yeah.
But not hurricanes, not earthquakes. Yeah,
yeah, right. Exactly. It's another great reason to have a data center here.
Okay. Well, if people want to get more information from 123net about these technologies, how do they get a hold of you?
Well, they're going to go actually to our website, which is really www.123net/data-center. But we will be hosting a webinar specifically on high density colocation and mobility. And that's going to be basically our URL again, which is 123.net/drivebigdata altogether.
What's the date on that?
That's going to be on October 25th.
Okay.
All right. And this Thursday, the President's Symposium at Lawrence Tech is going to be on.
Thank you, Richard.
Is going to be on the future of mobility. So it's going to talk about connected vehicles, autonomous vehicles, and basically how we get mobility for all in an increasingly urban society.
And Mark Brucky twisted my arm to come out and shoot video that night. So
oh, that's awesome!
I will be there as well, and I'm sure that You are going to be yes. there? All right. And we're going to have the whole band together.
All right, cool. Sorry. And I was going to say, the moderator of it's a pretty high-powered panel, and the moderator of the panel is Kirk Steidel, an 87 Lawrence Tech grad who's just announced his retirement.
Oh, yes, we had to say Lawrence Tech, yes.
Yes, so he just announced his retirement as a director of the Michigan Department of Transportation.
Oh, he did? I missed that.
Yeah, yep, he'll be leaving.
Oh.
So they're looking for a new director. So if you're looking for a new job.
No.
Okay.
No, that's not me.
You don't
no.
want to be the transportation
me,
boss
no,
in Michigan?
No.
Oh, okay. All right, well, I want to thank John Ironman from 123Net for his appearance here today. I want to thank all our guests today, including cybersecurity expert Richard Steenan, Invest Detroit's Tim Berchet, and her guest Peter Falzone, CEO of Ripple Science. We started off the day with Lisa Reynolds of the Michigan Science Center and Leslie Tom of the Charles H. Wright Museum.
Michael, a little bit of everything in this show.
And really fast once again. This is the fastest hour in radio, I think.
Yeah. People go, can't fill 14 minutes? And I go, yes, you can. It goes by really fast.
Okay. Meanwhile, we filled an hour. We got to get out of here.
Yes, and I'm getting the signal here from Jessica. It's not a good signal, so we have to stop.
Okay, so we'll see you next week, 2 p.m. Eastern time on the M-Squared TechCast. This is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M-Squared TechCast.
Thanks for listening to M-Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Join your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan, next Monday at 3 p.m. If you can't listen live, audio podcasts of the show can be found at podcastdetroit.com.